have sailed. I have moved about this world of ours, and ever in search of the finest of its kind, we bring you the tops in Spine Chillers.
And you are listening to Radio Masterpieces on Valley 103.1, serving Duval, Carnation, and Redmond Ridge.
Folks are dumb where I come from. They ain't had any learning. Still they're happy as can be, doing what comes naturally.
Doing what comes naturally.
Folks like us could never fuss with schools and books and learning. Still we've gone from A to Z, doing what comes naturally.
Doing what comes naturally.
You don't have to know how to read or write when you're out with a fella in the pale moonlight. You don't have to look in a book to find what he thinks of the moon and what is on his mind. That comes naturally.
That comes naturally.
My uncle out in Texas can't even write his name. He signs his checks with X's and they cash them just the same. Grandpa Dick was always sick but never saw a doctor. He just died at 93 doing what comes naturally.
Doing what comes naturally.
Cousin Jack insured his shack and now he plays with matches. He'll collect, just wait and see, doing what comes naturally.
Doing what comes naturally.
Uncle Paul heard someone call when he just had two deuces. He wound up with aces three, doing what comes naturally.
Doing what comes naturally. You don't have to go to a private school not to turn up your bustle to a stubborn mule. You don't have to have a professor's dome not to go for the honey when the bee's at home.
That comes naturally.
That comes naturally.
A nice young man named Harry is stuck on Sister Flo. She'd like to marry Harry, but his wife won't let him go. If you saw my pa and ma, you'd know they had no learning. Still they raised a family, doing what comes naturally.
Doing what comes naturally.
Doing what comes naturally.
Doing what comes naturally.
This is Bruce Kaplan, welcoming you back to another episode of Radio Masterpieces. Hope you're all having a great weekend. Tonight, we have two delicious mysteries. The second one is really one that I think is a little off the wall. It was from The Mysterious Traveler, but it's kind of an interesting mystery with a surprise ending. Well, they all have surprise endings. We begin with an episode of The Whistler, and that is very well done, and I think you'll really enjoy it. I think you'll enjoy the second one, too. Maybe I should have played it just on Halloween. If you have any questions for me, please don't hesitate to write to bruce@radiomasterpieces.com and tell me what you'd like to hear, and I'll sure try to get it for you, if I can, in the archives from the 1940s to early 1950s. Have a wonderful weekend, and now let's enjoy our show.
Now the Whistler's strange story. 2-year plan.
It had taken Eddie Davis exactly 2 years to swing it. And 2 years was very good time, even for a smart lawyer like Eddie. They'd all thought he was crazy when he left a promising job for the established law firm of Garden, Walker, and Reed to set up his own practice with just one client on the books, old Peter Jackson.
Now, Mr. Davis, as you know, my holdings run around $5 million. I must have a man in whom I can place complete trust.
I see. I think you'll discover you can trust me, Mr. Jackson.
That remains to be seen, Mr. Davis. That remains to be seen.
Yes, you went to work for Peter Jackson, Eddie, because he needed someone he could trust those 5 million to. Only a few months later, he was singing a different tune.
Eddie, that's wonderful.
Nothing to it, Pete.
You say old Hamilton didn't know Columbia Stores wanted that corner of his?
Well, you don't think he'd let it go for 40,000 if he did, do you?
Eddie, believe it or not, this time it isn't the money. For the first time in my life, I've got the jump on Hamilton. You know, Eddie.
Yeah?
You're doing a great job for me. A great job.
The next jump was the long one, wasn't it, Eddie? It took a lot of work and more than a year of waiting, but you'd figured it for the long pull and kept telling yourself you had all the time in the world. You knew when Peter finally came around, he'd drop it in with other business like a casual remark on the weather. But you were ready for it. You didn't bat an eye.
Take care of that lease renewal on the 48th Street place, will you? It comes up on the 12th.
Right. Well, I guess that does it, Pete. I better be on my way.
Oh, and another thing, Eddie.
Hmm?
While you're downtown, drop by the bank and pick up my will, will you?
Your will?
Yes. I'd like to look it over.
Okay. I'll bring it up this afternoon.
You're not going to ask me why?
Well, I think that's your business, Pete.
Yeah. I'm glad you look at it that way. You know, I've done a lot of thinking during the last few months, Eddie. I suppose a man gets a little philosophical when he passes the 65 mark. Everything suddenly seemed a little silly to me.
Silly? What do you mean?
Oh, sweating and straining to pile up another million before I die. Working for someone 3,000 miles away whom I've never seen.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Naturally you don't. You've never asked me about my will, Eddie. And I can't help but admire you for it.
But what's this about working for someone you've never seen?
The beneficiary.
Oh.
Name of Shelby Gordon, living in Vancouver, British Columbia. Only living relative I have, by the way. Not even a blood relation. Eddie, I've come to admire you very much. I like you. Like the way you do things.
Well, thanks, boss.
I've found something in you, Eddie.
Oh?
Something I've never had before. Something I've never been able to buy.
What's that?
Friendship. So, that's why I want you to get out the will. I'm making you my beneficiary.
And that was it, Eddie. 2 years almost to the day. And there's a new will. Signed, sealed, and witnessed. With your name in the right place. Simply because no one else in town was smart enough to see that old Peter Jackson was a pushover for the right boy. It's legal now. You send off the new will to the recorder's office, and Peter writes a personal letter to notify the former beneficiary in Vancouver, because that's the way he does business. There's nothing between you and that 5 million, Eddie, but time. That was January. Then, on a bright afternoon in mid-April, he does something with words he could have done better with a baseball bat. You walk into his office, bright and cheery as usual, and he looks up from his desk, smiling.
Oh, Eddie. Glad you came. Got some news for you.
What is it this time? We buying another brick heap?
No. Something more important than that.
Now, wait a minute. Let me guess. You put another deal over on Hamilton.
You'd never guess in a million years, Eddie. I'm getting married.
Huh? Married?
I told you you'd never guess.
Yeah. You're right.
Decided I'd been a bachelor too long. Sounds silly, doesn't it? Getting married for the first time at 65. Still, I've heard of others.
Who is she?
A young lady. Tenant of mine in the Riverside Drive place.
A young woman, huh?
Yes. Why?
How young? 40, 45?
I said young, Eddie. Marcia's 24.
24? Oh, now, wait a minute.
I know what you're going to say.
No, but Pete,
don't
you...
say it. I want you to meet Marcia first.
Okay.
Better get ready. She's meeting us in the Astor Lounge in half an hour. No congratulations.
Your suggestion was a good one, boss. Suppose I meet her first, huh?
Yes, Eddie. Your client and friend, Peter Jackson, could have done it better with a baseball bat. Somehow, though, you managed not to show the shock. The sinking feeling inside you as you stood there in his office while he calmly told you he'd gone off the deep end. You listened to him talk about Marcia McElroy in the taxi on the way to the Astor. And by the time the two of you walk into the lobby, you figure your chances of holding on to that $5 million, if the marriage goes through, are about those of a lame goat in the Kentucky Derby. You follow Peter into the lounge, and suddenly he's saying,
Marcia, dear, I want you to meet Mr. Davis, my attorney. Eddie, Marcia McElroy, my fiancée.
Hello, Mr. Davis. Peter has told me so much about you.
What's the matter, Eddie? Cat got your tongue?
Hmm? Oh, I'm sorry. Hello, Miss McElroy.
And you know at that moment that she holds all the cards you have, and several more. Yes, Eddie, you've seen beautiful women in your time, but nothing ever to compare with Marcia. With her jet black hair and creamy skin, and eyes that seem to change from blue to violet to purple. The kind of eyes that make you stutter and wobble at the knees. And Peter is proud of her. You can see that, too. She leaves the two of you alone for a moment over your coffee and cigars, almost as if she knew you were waiting for an opportunity to discuss her.
Well, Eddie, what about the congratulations now?
She's very charming, Pete. Quite beautiful, too.
You approve?
You mind if I speak frankly?
Oh, you've got a right to. You're my best friend.
She's marrying you for your money.
I knew that was coming.
Look, she's 24 and you're 65. Now, does that make sense?
Go on, Eddie.
Well, 2 months after your marriage, she'll be after everything you've got. And if you don't give it to her, you'll find yourself defendant in a separation suit and she'll be using those gorgeous eyes of hers on a jury.
I think you're wrong.
Okay, I'll make you a little bet. I'll draw up a marriage contract. Oh, it isn't very usual nowadays, but it'll save you paying through the nose later. If Marcia marries you in the face of the kind of marriage contract I draw, I'll eat crow until it comes out of my ears. Now, that's fair enough, isn't it?
You'll give us your blessings, then?
Pete, if she signs that contract, you can make me number one flower girl.
Good. Bring it around tomorrow. I'll have her there to sign it.
Mr. Davis, Peter's been telling me you think I should sign some sort of agreement before we're married.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I have it right here. I think it's best to sort of clarify things ahead of time
Oh, stop hemming and hawing, Eddie. I've already told Marcia why you thought she should sign it. She has no objections at all.
Peter, you're embarrassing, Mr. Davis.
Come on, Eddie. Let's see it.
Oh, it looks so legal.
Well, briefly, Miss McElroy, it provides for the amount of money you're to have as an allowance while you're married. And, it also provides for any alimony or claim for support in the event of a divorce or separation.
I see. And how much is it to be?
Well, the allowance is $75 a week. And in the event of divorce or separation, nothing.
Well, what do you think, Marcia?
Do I have to sign it as is?
You mean you have some objection?
Well, I suppose I do.
Oh?
What is it, Marcia?
Well, I think the allowance is entirely too much. You better make it $50. After all, Peter, with you to take care of me, what in the world would I do with $75 a week?
No, Eddie. You'll never understand it. You can't believe she's genuine, yet there it was right in front of you in black and white. And you're more confused than ever, because deep inside you, mixed up with the dollars and cents, tangled with your rivalry with her for the $5 million, you know you're in love with her, just as lost as Peter is in those deep blue eyes. There's only one possible answer, of course. She's like you are, playing it the smart way, concentrating on that $5 million inheritance. It's 3 weeks after the wedding before you get another chance to be with her alone. Peter had called that he wouldn't be at the office all day, and you're working there alone when she comes in.
Well, Marcia.
Hello.
How's the bride?
Happy, thank you.
What brings you downtown?
Well, let's see. Is it two things or three? First of all, Peter has a cold.
A cold.
Oh. Secondly, he asked me to do a few errands for him. And third, guess.
I'll bite what?
I thought you might ask me to lunch.
Oh, sounds great.
What are you working on?
A copy of Peter's will.
Oh, then.
Yes, that. Now that he's married, you know, there'll have to be some provision for you, one way or another.
Does it?
Oh, come on now, let's not go through that again.
No, I'm interested.
Yeah, I should think you would be. That's why you married him, isn't it?
You're being rather cruel.
Oh, now drop it, will you? We're alone here. You can let down your hair. Oh, I admit you threw me an awful curve with that marriage contract. As a rule, you know, gold diggers will sacrifice the long pull in favor of ready cash.
Please, Eddie.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Don't you see? I'm trying to make him happy, Eddie. Trying to give him something to believe in. Anyone understand that?
No.
There's no way I can convince you?
Yeah. There's one way.
Well, what's that?
Sign away your interest in the estate.
I see.
Uh-huh.
You're genuine, though, aren't you? You're a real friend to him. You don't care about his money.
What's that got to do with it?
Well, he told me you're the current beneficiary in his will.
Oh? How'd you get that out of him? Third degree or thumb screws?
Did you have to say that?
Oh. I'm sorry.
See, I can't help wondering about you, Eddie.
Yeah, well, I'll leave that up to Peter.
Well, he's wondering, too. You seem so concerned about the marriage.
What'd you tell him?
Nothing.
I see.
Would I convince you if I signed away my interest in the will?
After that, baby, I'd believe anything.
You'd convince me if you signed away yours. I already told you that the money didn't make any difference to me. What about you?
He's my best friend. Does that answer your question?
There's only one way you can answer it, Eddie. We can go to him together and tell him we want the will restored to its original state, just as it was before he met either.
You mean leave his money to that Shelby Gordon in Vancouver?
That's right.
Oh.
Well, which is it? Peter as a friend or his money? I'm sure he'll be glad to know.
Do you really mean that? You'd give it all up for...
Of course I do.
Oh, no. You're not human. You're not human at all. You're out of this world.
You believe in me now?
Oh, it just doesn't make sense, Marcia. You're young. You're the most beautiful girl I ever saw in my life. Pete is 65. I told myself the will was the only possible answer.
You've been terribly hard to convince.
Well, they don't come like you. Not even in dreams.
You're awfully sweet.
I don't need to tell you, I guess. Women have a way of knowing, anyhow. Marcia, I...
Please, don't say it. It isn't right.
I'm sorry. I'm not used to playing the second string. I just want you to remember that... But after Pete's gone, I'll be around, waiting.
I'll remember that. Well... Are we going to see Peter about changing the will back to the original beneficiary?
Yeah. You know, you're not only beautiful, Marcia, you're smart. If I refuse, he disinherits me anyway, because my motives aren't pure. You win. Let's go see Peter.
But first...
What?
Lunch.
Well, Eddie, you have to believe in her now, don't you? There just aren't any other answers. The 2 years you invested in Peter Jackson went for nothing. The dreams of the $5 million fell to pieces before this girl whose only weapon was honesty. And somehow you find you can take it. One look from those blue eyes and you'd buy her Grant's tomb and make a down payment on the Brooklyn Bridge. A week after the new will is signed, reinstating Shelby Gorton of Vancouver, the original beneficiary, Peter calls to say he's not feeling well again and asks if you'd mind driving her home after an afternoon of shopping.
It's been awfully sweet of you to drive me home, Eddie.
Marcia?
Yes?
Oh, I better skip it, I guess.
What are you trying to tell me, Eddie? You've started to say something 3 times in the last 5 minutes.
Well, Marcia, it's about the will.
Oh, again?
Yeah, again. Now, believe it or not, I'm only thinking of you this time.
What is it now?
Well, it's not fair to you. No, don't look at me that way. He ought to provide for you. You've got a legal right to it.
I told you I don't.
Now, wait a minute. You might as well know all of it. Now, the will is signed and witnessed on page 3. I drew it up that way.
Mm.
It's still down in my office safe. I've got a right to keep it there because I'm Peter's executor.
But I don't see what
difference... Well, it's just this. The beneficiary is shown on page 2. It'll make no difference whatsoever to Peter if I draw up a new page with you as beneficiary.
Why, Eddie, that'd be forgery.
I know it. For you, I'd take the chance. Look, he doesn't care a rap for this Shelby Gorton in Vancouver. He's never even seen him.
I don't want it, Eddie. I don't want you to touch it. Is that clear?
You mean you'd expose me if I did?
Why, I don't know.
Well. Here we are.
You've got to promise me, Eddie.
No, let's not talk about it here. Now, wait a minute. Look, here comes the maid.
Mr. Jackson!
Something's wrong.
Oh, Mr. Jackson, I've been trying to get you.
What's the matter?
It's Mr. Jackson. He's had a stroke.
Oh, Peter!
It's awful.
Did you get a doctor?
Yes, he's up there now. I'm afraid Mr. Jackson's gone.
Oh, Eddie, come on. We'd better hurry.
No. I've got to get back to the office. Don't argue with me. Go up and talk to the doctor. I told you I've got to get back to the office.
And there's a good reason, isn't there, Eddie? As you race down the parkway toward town, page 2 of the will falls into place in your mind. Only the 3 of you knew the context, because you'd been clever enough to call in the witnesses only for the signatures. Yes, Eddie, you knew you'd never have a chance with your own name there, but with Marsha's, the 2-year plan might pay off after all. It takes you only a few minutes to draw up the new page and insert it between the others, replacing the black ribbon just as it was before, and carefully put it back in the safe. You still aren't sure of Marcia, but with $5 million at stake, you know it's worth the gamble. The 2 of you meet at the funeral and sit side by side during the services. But you know that now isn't the time to tell her, that you'll have to wait until later, after you've filed the will for probate.
Here you are. Jackson's death came so unexpectedly, I planned to bring the will down this week, but...
Properly executed, witnessed, so on. Now, I don't think there'll be any difficulty. Mrs. Jackson will be the natural beneficiary, of course.
Yes, of course.
Mr. Davis.
Hello, Anna. Mrs. Jackson in?
Why, didn't you know?
Know what?
She's gone away. Left right after the funeral.
Where?
She didn't say. Poor thing was pretty hard hit by Mr. Jackson's death, you know. Expect she's gone up to the mountains or somewhere. Oh, she left a note for you.
A note? Where is it?
You'll find it right there on the hall table.
A note? What's she writing notes for? Dear Eddie, I'm writing you this because I'm leaving now for good, and I know we'll never see each other again.
Thanks so much for your kind services. I appreciate everything you've done more than I can say. It was strictly business, you know. So I want you to send me a bill. You're a smart lawyer and a wonderful friend. Cordially, Marcia Jackson. Cordially, Marcia Jackson. Cordially.
Is there something wrong, Mr. Davis?
Anna, you want to know what the nastiest word is in the English language?
Oh, please, sir.
Cordially, Anna. Cordially.
So she's gone, Eddie. All the dreams, all the visions of you and Marcia and Peter Jackson's $5 million are gone. Vanished into thin air. And for the first time in your life, you have to admit someone made a sucker out of you. The will's gone in for probate now, and you have a choice to make. Either you can let it stand and allow Marcia to collect the estate, or you can set things right, admit to a forgery, and perhaps give the state a chance at a 2-year plan of its own. For 3 days, it churns around in your mind, keeps you from anything else. Then, with the reading of the will only a day off, you make your decision and walk into the district attorney's office. He's interested in what you have to say.
Well, that's it. I was in love with her. I think it was more that, the end at least, than anything else. I wanted to see her get what was coming to her.
And naturally, you hope that the
there's no point in denying it. Now that it's over, I want to set things straight. Now, don't get me wrong, D.A. It's not because I'm so honest.
You just don't want to let her make a sucker out of you, huh?
That's right. She has no claim on the estate. The money belongs to a distant relative, a guy named Shelby Gordon. Lives in Vancouver. I have the genuine pages of the will right here.
Oh, good. Incidentally, I don't think you'll have to worry about the forgery charge, Eddie. Doesn't make much difference anyway. And
what do you mean? Look, I don't know what league you play in, but $5 million is a big difference to me.
What did you call her, Eddie? A beautiful question mark?
Yeah.
Well, a probate court called yesterday. Asked us to check on her. You see, there was a reason why she came to New York and married Peter Jackson after he'd made a new will in your favor.
What?
We thought there might be a loophole somewhere. Possible fraud. But there isn't any. She's too smart. You see, before she came here, she had her name legally changed to Marcia McElroy. Her real name was Shelby Gordon. Lives in Vancouver.
Valley 103.1 FM.
I died last night.
My friend, Mr. Gregory Raymond, was going to tell you of his strange experience. He's a man of middle age with bushy gray hair and the nervous intensity of one who has concentrated his whole life upon a single absorbing interest. As he proceeds with his tale, please overlook the inconsequential fact that he is dead.
My name is Gregory Raymond, and it is perfectly true that all my life I was concentrated upon a single interest, the study of death and what comes after. Even from boyhood, that one interest absorbed me. I made 1,000 efforts to penetrate the baffling veil that separates life from death, to effect communication with those on the other side of the dark curtain. And in this effort, I had no success until I met that man of great wisdom from the East. Then I knew I had found the teacher I needed. I studied daily for months. I devoted my entire fortune to the project. And we were just on the brink of success when one evening the yogi kept me with him after the others had left.
My friend Gregory, it is necessary that you and I should talk.
Of course. You seem troubled.
I am, Gregory. We have come close to success in our studies here, have we not?
Closer than I ever dared hope we would.
If now we could only tear away the last veil of ignorance that separates us from the truth. If we could only see through to the other side of the wall of death.
Patience, my friend. Death is a subject that has engrossed man's mind for a million years. We cannot expect to solve its dark mysteries in a few months.
No, of course not, but I've spent a lifetime trying, and I suppose I'm a little impatient.
I, too, have spent a lifetime just preparing to make the study. And now that success is in sight, it grieves me to say that we must discontinue our study.
Discontinue them? Just when we were getting somewhere? Well, no, we can't.
We have no choice.
But why? Why must we stop now when we're so close?
For the simplest reason in the world. We lack the money to continue.
Oh, money? Is that the trouble?
We need trained assistants, scientific instruments, many things to aid us. All this requires money, and we do not have it.
Well, how much?
Many thousands. $100,000, perhaps.
$100,000? It's a lot. But we'll get it. We have to.
Alas, my friend, I do not know where.
Listen, my brother, John, is a rich man. He's head of the Raymond Foundation, which makes grants for all kinds of important studies.
Yes, I have heard so.
I'll ask him for the money. For a cause like this, he'll give it to us. I know it.
It would mean everything to us. But suppose he refuses?
He won't refuse. And if he does, I'll get the money from him somehow. I swear it. The next day, I hurried to Hollywood, where John had his home on top of the cliff that looks out over the beach and the ocean beyond. When I reached the house, old Charles, the gardener, told me that John had gone for a walk to his favorite spot, a high point on the cliff that looked far out across the ocean. I hurried there and found him alone, smoking and watching the sunset. Swiftly, I told him why I'd come. And to my amazement, he refused my request.
Gregory, my answer is emphatically no. I will not put up money for any such crackpot scheme.
But, John, you're head of the Raymond Foundation. Father left it millions to carry on research in every field of human welfare.
And you consider this wild notion of yours a field of human welfare?
Well, of course it is. Don't you understand? We're on the very verge of solving the greatest mystery of all, the mystery of death, and what follows.
Indeed, Gregory.
But it's true. We only need a little more time and money.
Time and money.
And when we've succeeded, when we've definitely established communication with those who have left this sphere of existence, think what that will mean to the world.
Just what will it mean to the world?
Swoosh. It will mean everything. Think of the comfort it will give mankind. The peace of mind. The tranquility of soul that will result when we know what is to come. What our future life is to be like. Can't you see that?
No, I'm afraid I can't. Old-fashioned faith is good enough for me. Furthermore, there can never be such communication as you're dreaming of. It's impossible.
But it isn't for you.
He's nothing but a trickster and a charlatan running a nice little racket to get money out of deluded fools like you.
That's not true.
I tell you it is. While I live, the Raymond Foundation will never furnish a cent for this fantastic scheme.
No, John, you can't refuse me. You can't.
I do, Gregory. That's final.
I see. I'm sorry you said that, John.
What do you mean?
I see that there's only one thing that I can do.
What the devil are you getting at?
This project must not be allowed to fail. It means so much that the life of one man is a small price to pay for that success.
Well, what nonsense are you talking?
When you're dead, I shall become the head of the Raymond Foundation.
Gregory, get away from me. Take your hand off me.
No, John, you wouldn't listen to reason, so I have no alternative.
Gregory, let go of me. You're pushing me through the cliff, Gregory.
Believe me, John, I don't want to do this, but our study cannot be allowed to fail.
Gregory, come to your senses. You're out of your mind.
You'll see, John, in just a moment you'll know that I'm right.
No! No!
Far below me, John lay still. I felt a vast pity for him, but I had done the only thing possible. and I was sure that John, wherever he might be then, agreed with me. I returned to the house, broke the sad news that John had had an unfortunate accident, and wired for John's son and daughter, Jack and Susan, who were at college, to fly home at once. The next evening, Jack and Susan arrived, pale and upset. I took them into the library to explain the whole sad occurrence to them.
Uncle Gregory, you say that Father had a dizzy spell and fell over the cliff before you could catch him.
Yes, Jack. It happened so fast I could do nothing.
But Father never got dizzy. His health was perfect.
He was smoking a cigar, Susan. He complained that he felt a little unwell, and a moment later he staggered and was gone. I feel terribly about this, believe me.
You don't look very upset, Uncle Gregory.
Oh, but I am, Jack. But I know that wherever your father is now, he's happier by far than any of us.
Are you sure that's the reason you're so cheerful, Uncle Gregory?
What do you mean by that?
She means the gardener tells a very different story.
The gardener? What's the gardener got to do with it?
He saw you and Father talking at the top of the cliff. He said you were arguing.
Arguing? Well, that's nonsense. I was just explaining to John my scheme for scientifically attacking the problem of communication with the next world.
Uncle Gregory, the gardener says he doesn't think Father fell.
Then what does he think?
He thinks he saw you push Father off the cliff.
That is utter nonsense. He saw me try to grab John as he was falling, that's all.
I wish I could believe that. But I can't.
Jack, you must. Uncle Gregory couldn't have pushed Father. It just isn't possible.
Of course not, Susan, and I'm glad that you at least realize
that. I'm not so sure. He seems awfully pleased about being head of the Raymond Foundation now.
Now listen to me, both of you. The coroner says that your father died accidentally, and that ends matters.
Not for me, it doesn't.
And just what do you think you're going to do, Jack?
I don't know yet. But I'm going to Dad's lawyers and have you declared incompetent to handle the Raymond Foundation.
I warn you, I'll brook no interference. I am head of the Foundation, and from now on it will be run as I say.
Not if I can help it.
And the first thing I'm going to do is pour all the resources of the Foundation into an institute for the study of death.
Uncle Gregory, you can't mean that. The Foundation scientists are on the verge of a cure for cancer, for tuberculosis. You can't stop their work now.
I can and I will.
Now I'm certain you killed Dad. You killed him to get control of the Foundation for your crazy scheme.
You get out. Get out. Both of you. Get out.
Jack, catch him.
He swung at me. He lost his balance. I couldn't catch him.
He's flying so still. He hit his head on the fireplace as he fell. It's bleeding. Jack, is he all right?
Just a minute and I'll see.
Jack bent over me. I had lost my temper and, in trying to hit him, had fallen. And now I lay on the floor, a great pain throbbing in my head and a strange darkness creeping up all around me. As Jack and Susan leaned over me, the darkness closed in and I felt myself drifting away into an unknown land. And just before the darkness became complete, I could hear their words.
Jack, how is he? He doesn't seem to be breathing. Is he dead?
Yes, Susan. All his life, Uncle Gregory has been trying to learn what happens when you die. Well, now, at last, he's going to find out.
How long I lay in that dark nothingness, I do not know. But at long last, consciousness began to return to me. First, I realized that the sweet, cloying scent of flowers was heavy in my nostrils. Then I opened my eyes. I lay on a couch at one end of a great, dim room with windows of stained glass, like a church. And then at the other end of the room, I saw three coffins. One of the coffins was banked with flowers, and candles burned at either end of it. Dazed and bewildered, I got to my feet and walked slowly toward them. I reached the side of the one covered with flowers and stared through the small glass plate at the man inside, and then I knew the body in the coffin was mine.
Oh, you mustn't be so upset, mister. Most of us feel pretty startled at first.
Yes. Joshua and I were upset just as you are. But this will pass soon.
I whirled about and saw two dim figures coming toward me from the shadows. They were smiling, and I knew that they were trying to be helpful. Who are you?
I'm Joshua Brown. This is my wife, Nellie. Our bodies are in the other two coffins.
Your bodies? I don't understand.
Of course. You're still confused. That's only natural.
Look through the glass in this coffin. That's my body. There, you see?
Yes, it looks just like you.
Yes, of course it is me. The earthly me.
Well, then we're really dead, all three of us?
Of course. You died last night. You slipped and fell and hit your head.
Yes, I remember now.
It's taken you until now to become aware of things, to get over the shock.
But where am I?
This is the mortuary chapel of the cemetery. They'll be coming for you soon to prepare to bury you.
To bury me? No.
Oh, you mustn't be upset. Just to bury the mortal you. The empty shell you've left behind.
Yes. Nellie and I were killed 2 nights ago in an auto accident. But we won't be buried until tomorrow, when our son gets here.
But I never dreamed that it would be like this. Why, I can still see and hear. I still breathe. My heart still beats.
Not really. You're used to those things, so they let you think there hasn't been much change until you get over your first shock. They're very thoughtful.
They? Who do you mean?
The ones in charge. Well, you'll know more about them soon. Mr. Benedict will be coming for us, and I expect he'll take you along, too.
Who's Mr. Benedict?
He's our guide. He stopped last night to tell us not to worry and to wait for him. He'll take us on to the next place.
Oh, shh. Someone's coming. We must get that here out of the way.
We stepped back a few paces as the door opened. Four men entered, pushing a carriage on rubber-tired wheels. Behind them came Jack and Susan dressed in mourning. They advanced toward the coffin that held my mortal body.
All right, men, take it easy now. That's it. Four lift together.
They lifted and placed the coffin on the wheeled carriage that they'd brought. And a sudden panic struck me, a sudden fear that made me cry out, Jack! Susan! No, you mustn't. You can't bury me. I'm not dead. I can't be.
Oh, please, you mustn't give way. It's perfectly natural, really, it is.
No, let go of me. I've got to make them understand that I'm not really dead. Let go of me. Jack! Susan!
Please, you mustn't distress yourself. You see, they can't hear you.
It was true. None of them so much as turned. The four men wheeled my coffin out. Jack and Susan followed, and the door closed. I was alone again with the Browns. They didn't hear me. They didn't pay any attention to me.
It was impossible for them to hear you. We cannot communicate with the living, nor they with us.
But it must be possible.
I'm sorry, but really it isn't. Mr. Benedict said so.
But all my life I've worked to establish such communication, and now I have so much to tell the world. The people that I've worked with, you must tell them all. I must reach them somehow.
But if it is possible, Mr. Benedict will tell you, I'm sure. No, please. The only thing we can do is be quiet and wait for him.
Stunned, I sank into a chair. There was no doubt about it. I had died last night, and this was what came after. But I knew the Browns were wrong. There was some way to reach the ones that I left behind. I knew. The yogi had proved it to me. And so I waited for Mr. Benedict. I don't know how long it was, but suddenly a strange musical note sang in my ears. I looked up. A shaft of white light shone directly down into the center of the room. And in it stood a tall figure, hidden in a flowing robe. The light winked out, and the figure strode toward him.
Are you ready, Mr. and Mrs. Brown?
Yes, Mr. Benedict. Oh, Mr. Raymond, this is Mr. Benedict. He's come for us now.
Yes, it is time. We must go.
But I can't go yet. I've got to tell people, the people that I've worked with. We've worked so hard to find out the truth, and now...
It may not be. Now, Mr. and Mrs. Brown, it is time.
Sure, Mr. Benedict, we're ready. But Mr. Raymond is coming with us, isn't he?
He is not coming.
Not coming? But why, Mr. Benedict?
He is doomed to remain here on Earth for all eternity.
What do you mean? What are you saying?
This is your punishment. To remain forever a spirit that moves unseen and unheard among men.
But why is he being punished, Mr. Benedict?
He knows. That is sufficient. Now come, we must go.
No, wait. You've got to take me with you. But they didn't wait. They took a step, two steps, and were gone. Where they'd vanished, heavy curtains rustled against the wall. I rushed over to them and flung them back. There was no wall. I could see straight out into a peaceful cemetery, and across the green grass, Mr. Benedict and the Browns were walking away. I hurried after them, and something stopped me. An invisible barrier across my path, cold, unyielding, like glass. I beat against the invisible barrier with my hands. I cried out, and no one heard, no one noticed. And at last, exhausted, I see. Jack and Susan were slowly walking toward me. They came down a little path and stopped not 5 feet from me, yet they did not see me. And they were talking about me.
Well, it's all over, Susan. Uncle Greg and Father are both gone. We've got to face the fact.
I know, Jack, but do you think Uncle really did kill Father? I don't want to believe it.
Well, I guess we'll never know. But if he did, he's been punished for it.
Perhaps this punishment is worse than we can ever guess. Do you suppose that now, wherever he is, he's trying to tell the world what he knows?
Probably, Susan. But if only Gregory hadn't become such a fanatic on the subject, none of this would ever have happened.
They started to move away. And again I cried out to them, Jack, Susan, listen to me. You've got to hear me. You've got to. But they didn't turn. They didn't hear. They couldn't. They were alive. And I was dead. At last, despairing, I turned. And there was Mr. Benedict again, watching me, his deep-set eyes, expressionless.
Gregory Raymond, do you believe at last? Are you convinced now that there can be no communication?
No, the mucky crewmate.
He was a trickster. Seeking money from you. The most heartless kind of trickster, preying on your hope.
I don't believe it.
You must resign yourself to the truth. We are not unkind. We do not wish you to be tormented unnecessarily. Come with me. I shall show you.
He took me by the hand and led me across the room. The door opened silently before we reached it and shut behind us as we passed through. We went down a corridor and came to a small room where a girl sat at a desk typing. We entered, and she did not look up.
She is typing the necessary documents concerning your burial tomorrow, Gregory Raymond. Do you wish to speak to her?
Yes, I do. Young lady, listen to me. I'm Gregory Raymond, here, standing beside you.
She does not hear you.
You don't have to answer me. Just stop typing. Anything to show that you know that I'm speaking to you.
You see? Now come, we shall try further.
We continue down the hallway. And we came to another room. In this one, a man sat,
We paused in the doorway and watched him. He was telephoning.
Hello, obituary editor. This is the Stonefield Chapel calling. Will you run an announcement, please, saying the services for the late Gregory Raymond will be held Thursday at 4 o'clock? That is correct. From the chapel. Only the family will be present. Thank you.
You may try to speak to him if you wish.
My friend, can you hear me? Please, just look around.
Oh, hello, evening lecture. The obituary editor, please.
Please, you must hear me. You must. I have to let the world know all that I've learned.
Oh, hello, obituary editor. This is the Stonefield Chapel calling. Will you take down an announcement, please? Oh. All right. Yes, I'll wait.
He cannot hear. But perhaps someone else may. We will try again if you wish.
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. Someone, somewhere, will be able to hear me. We went on down the corridor, and another door opened before us. We stepped through onto green lawn. Mr. Benedict led me across it through a little gate and into a small cemetery that lay hushed in the shade of great trees. There, two men were digging. We paused beside them.
Do you know what they are digging, Gregory Raymond?
Yes, a grave.
Your grave? Where your earthly body shall rest while you roam the world unseen, unheard.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Speak to them. See if they can hear you.
I will. You two men, listen to me. I'm Gregory Raymond. Do you hear?
They do not hear.
You've got to listen to me. Just give me some sign that you hear something. Just stop digging for a minute. Anything.
You see? They do not pause. Thus it must be all. Your punishment is to remain here on this earthly plane. A lonely soul without hope.
Oh, no. Oh, no, I couldn't bear that. Take me with you. I don't care what happens to me, but don't leave me here like this.
I'm sorry. It cannot be otherwise.
But what have I done? What am I being punished for?
You know. I do not need to tell you.
You mean because I killed my brother?
That is for you to say, not for me to judge.
I did. I did kill him. I pushed him off the cliff when he refused the money that I asked for.
Are you confessing to his murder, Gregory Raymond?
Yes. Yes, I am. I killed him. It was an impulse. I didn't plan to do it. But I'm sorry now. Punish me any way you want, only don't leave me here like this.
Very well, Gregory Raymond. You shall be punished. An earthly punishment according to the laws of men.
What do you mean?
You two, you can stop digging now.
Brother.
You heard Gregory Raymond confess to the murder of his brother?
Well, all right, Lieutenant Benedict. We're sure glad it's over. These pickaxes are giving us bliss.
They heard us.
Yes, Mr. Raymond. Now you're under arrest for murder.
Under arrest? But that is impossible.
I'm afraid it is. You see, I'm Lieutenant Benedict of the Homicide Squad. You're not dead. You're very much alive.
No, I can't be. You're lying.
I'm afraid we played a little trick on you. Out here in Hollywood, we have some very good actors, and, well, you see, your nephew arranged the whole thing with actors, wax figures, and coffins, and weird atmosphere to see if he couldn't get a confession out of you.
No, I don't believe you.
He figured you had such a one-track mind on that, subject to death. When you knocked yourself unconscious, he decided to try and convince you you'd killed yourself.
No.
Though he succeeded better than we'd hoped. Now, will you come quietly, Mr. Raymond?
No. You can't arrest me. You can't arrest a dead man. And I'm dead. I know I am. I died last night.
In my merry old mobile.
Down the road of life we'll fly, awesome old bubbling, you and I.
And to the church we'll swiftly steal, then our wedding bells will peal.
You can go as far as you like with me
in my merry Oldsmobile.
If you want to see a car that's really full of sex appeal,
if you please,
come out riding in my jazzy, handy Oldsmobile.
Oh, you kid.
And if I should steal a kiss and tell me that you won't be busted,
don't get too big for your goggles and you're in the Duster Buster.
On the menu of romance, you are my very favorite course.
Oh, you do. With that corny line of yours, you really ought to get a horse.
No, it's too. How'd you like the pretty wedding ring?
Well, now, that's a very different thing.
In my merry Oldsmobile.
What a happy pair without a single care.
Merry Oldsmobile.
What a grand machine, a double peachy keen.
Merry Oldsmobile.
It's hydromatic, just like you.
What do you mean?
Why, the car is shiftless, too.
There's no clutch.
Well, what about me?
Ah, when I park, both hands will be free.
And not for long.
What a body. It's all streamlined.
Thank you.
With a little spare tire behind.
We go hand in glove down the road of love in my merry Oldsmobile.
L-O-V-E.
In my merry Oldsmobile.
O-U-Q-T.
In our merry Oldsmobile.
Sailed. I have moved about this world of ours, and ever in search of the finest of its kind, we bring you the tops in Spine Chillers.
And you are listening to Radio Masterpieces on Valley 103.1, serving Duval, Carnation, and Redmond Ridge. The door is slowly closing for Radio Masterpieces, but be sure and tune in again next week from 9 to 10 p.m. to listen to more wonderful mysteries from the 1940s and 50s. This is Bruce Kaplan signing off. Radio Masterpieces is a Seattle Miracle Incorporated production.